Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 5, delivered on February 6, 2017. The title of this lecture is Time Value of Money.
Today, the time value of money. Before I go to that subject, I do want to clean up financial statement analysis and give you some insights into how we read financial statements, old school style, along with some of the ratios that are important. And there are other ratios in the book that I won't cover in class. But I do also, in ReggieNet, now have up a nice formula sheet that shows you the most important formulas that you could that you might encounter or want to use in doing analysis of financial statements using ratios. But that's up on ReggieNet now, so you can download it and print it, maybe even have it laminated and put it up in a very important place in your apartment or whatever, okay, or not. But before I do the go on to time value of money, again, I do want to do just a bit more with financial statement of quite a bit more with financial statement analysis. And to start that off, I'm going to go to a screen and I'm going to ask you to show me that you know what I taught you in the last class. So in order for us to do this, I am going to look up a company. And I am going to do TGT. Target. And I'm going to start with some basic questions. See if you were paying attention last time. Really? For some reason, all this sucks. That's close enough. Okay. Madam, is this a safe stock or a risky stock?
It's a safer stock.
Why?
Because it has a lower beta.
I am impressed. This one is a safer stock in a well-diversified portfolio. If you held it on its own, you would very likely just get creamed. You would be in a rodeo on one of those bulls that goes, moo, okay, and then throws you around. But in a well-diversified portfolio, this is a safe stock. As a matter of fact, this one is almost downright defensive at 0.42. So you got a safe stock. This one has 42% in a well-diversified portfolio. This security has 42% of the volatility of the market portfolio. So if 1.00, the market portfolio, is like your fulcrum of risk, this one is actually a relatively safe stock. Matter of fact, quite safe. Now, the next question is, why is this a safe stock? Assessing that, you are doing more speculation, which you can back up to a certain extent with numbers and analyses, industry analyses and all that. But just to start it off, why would you consider this to be a safe stock? Why is the market thinking that? It doesn't move around a lot, does it? in a way, it's a very stable. But that kind of just says that the market thinks this is a safe stock. It doesn't buy, that it's not being swapped out and traded a lot. Something is telling the market that they don't need to worry about this company being in trouble too much. Even though when we look at the financial statements, we're going to see that this company actually is somewhat risky. I mean, this company was a little bit disturbing when you look at its financial statements. Any assessment from you? Why would the market think this is such a safe company? Well, that's okay. That's okay. It takes a while to start thinking about it. Let me try on you, sir. What do you think? Got no idea? Not a clue. Okay, now, what would you say? Is this a company that has... Let me do it this way. Competitors. Give me a competitor of Target.
Probably Walmart.
Yes, and interestingly enough, that's what most people would think. But you know as well as I do that Walmart really isn't a competitor for this company. The same people who go to Target are not likely to go to Walmart. Because when you go to Target, you are with upscale people, good people. When I go to Target, women walking with their kids pull their kids closer to them. But I go to Walmart, and I have to park out in another county. I nearly get hit by a truck that has a bumper sticker that says, "My wife, yes, my dog, maybe, my gun, never." I walk in the door and I hear, "Hi," and I look down, oh God, they're hiring midget greeters. I walk down an aisle and there's a big person standing there, "Honey, what do you want for dinner?" By the time I get to the line to check out, there are 30 people in the line. At the front is an elderly woman trying to use a debit card for the first time. Well, that was 20 times. It's just not worth it. Lady, I think that's your Social Security card. You need to pay your food. I'll pay for your food. You go home and eat. You're not well. You're going to die. You're old. Not a direct competitor. You see, Target has carved out a niche that is not being bothered by competitors too much. Walmart, Kmart, who's coming after them? Sears, JCPenney, none of their competitors is directly in the line of competition, and those that might be close are in bad shape. Gap, yeah, there's a great one that's a competitor for Target. No. So that explains a little bit about what market thinks is safe about this. It's not in an assailable position. It's in a harbor. It's created a harbor for itself. And that's a pretty cool thing. And there's a lot of criticism of Target, and you'll see in the financials that there are some real issues that we can look at that are troubling. But at the same time, give the company credit for creating something that is kind of interesting. Okay, now, I don't know why the bid and ask are acting up like that, but the day's range, that is a very small range. Now, as far as the stock price goes, it went down from, the open was at 63.77, and it closed at 63.42, down 33 cents. Are you going to lose sleep as an investor over that? That's exactly right. That's minimal. That's irrelevant. Look at percentage. Always look at percentage, not at absolute numbers. This is nothing. This is just a day's fart. Okay? So, moving along now. Here's a little bit more of an interesting thing. Ma'am, when you look at this stock, is it near its 52-week high or its 52-week low? Right now. Yes, it's close to its low. Now, give me a concern, and I know this is, I'm asking a lot of you early on, but can you give me an analysis? Is that a bad sign, a good sign, or is it a complicated sign? You're kind of freezing up there. Sir, how about you? You want to give me an idea? Complicated, yes. It's one of those complicated relationships. You see, it's near its low, which means that this stock has shown that it can be a lot higher than this. It has shown that it can be $84 a share. It's down there, down near its bottom, but it's not at its bottom. It looks to me as if the market is testing the low. It's probing it. It didn't get there. It chickened out, bumped back up, but it's not on its back. Go.
Don't like a lot of companies' earnings come out this week.
So yeah.
Expecting it to not turn out so well.
But when you were a kid, there were monsters in your closet. They actually really were. It's just that they sort of thought you were funny. You'd go up to the door and say, "I'm not afraid of you, monsters." They knew you were. You see, the market is afraid. It is going to say, "We're not afraid to drop this stock." But you can tell that they are afraid to drop that stock. They are saying, well, there's going to be bad earnings reports, so we're going to have problems. But why didn't they drop that through its neckline if they really, really believe that? The market is blinking. That's a tell right there on this. I am so glad you brought that up. You're absolutely right. But if they really thought this stock was going to drop tomorrow, they'd drop it today. That's the way the market works. Expectations are absorbed right now. They don't wait for tomorrow. They do it today. And if they really believed the target was going to go to thiscompanysucks.com, they would have dropped that price through that neckline, but they chickened out. They blinked. And that's what I'm seeing here. That's my assessment, okay? It's my guess. I don't know, though. Here's the deal. We've had a very difficult couple of months in the stock market. Right immediately after the election, the stock market nearly went to zombie apocalypse. And then it rallied 2,000 points on the Dow. I think it was the Dow. Just, oh, it's not what we thought it was. We take him seriously, but not literally. Now, suddenly, we are going plunging, and we are heading down into very serious possibility of a severe down market. The market has already shed 1,900 of those euphoria points. And so what we may be seeing here is a broader market effect going on. Here's the rule. Don't ever, ever fight a market. You don't do that. If you have ever surfed, you don't go into a cresting wave. You ride it back to the shore. So, and if the market really is going to go down hard and long, well, you know, there's nothing you can do about it, and Target isn't any different from any other company, except that it's going to be a safer investment than a lot of companies because of that beta 0.42. That's all that there is to that. Next thing I want to show you something. Beta, the market cap. The market cap of, volume. Notice that the volume, very much average volume, a little shade down, but nothing major on it. So I'm not going to get much out of that. I'm not going to get anything out of that. Other than this is there's nothing exciting going on about this. Interestingly enough, I don't see any weighting effect. See, when earnings are about to come out, sometimes you'll see volume slide downward as everyone who's a heavy backs off to wait to see if they were right or wrong. In this case, it's just kind of cruising along like it's a very typical stock that they already know what's going to happen. They're not going to punish it. There's not going to be a wild trading frenzy in it, anything like that. Market cap is $35.62 billion. Okay, so now if you can tell me, if you remember, Madam, what's market cap? Do you remember? That's okay. It's one of those things. Like I said, I pour a lot at you, and I do it in layers. I just keep doing the same things over and over because I don't expect you to know this stuff the first time or even have a vision of where this fits in your mind. And that's why we just do it over and over again, because that's the best way for you to learn this on a long-term basis. After all, I told you, I'm the best professor you ever had or ever will have. Do you remember what market cap is?
No.
Okay. That is, okay, the price per share times the number of shares outstanding. It is the market's assessment of the total value of the equity, the total value of ownership. It is the market's assessment of the total value of the ownership in the company. A cautionary tale for you, a cautionary tale. When I give you an in-class essay exam, you will answer 4 of 5 questions. I give you 5, you find 4. You give me 1 or 2 sentence answers. You go more than 2 sentences, I start knocking off a lot of points very fast because I don't have time to grade 400 dissertations. And when you give me your answer, don't give me a formula. If I say, what does market cap mean? And you say, well, that's a price per share times the number of shares outstanding. You will get no credit for that answer because I don't give a rat's ass if you know a formula. Rain Man knows formulas. Computers know formulas. I want you to tell me it is the market's assessment of the total value of the ownership in the company. That is the answer. A formula is never an answer, ever. And any professor or anyone who's ever told you that a formula is an answer is wrong. It's like those economics professors. They show you a supply and demand graph. Here's the answer. No, that's a crutch. That's a crippled mental intellectual's crutch. It's a graph of supply and demand to explain what is equilibrium price. And we're going to talk about equilibrium price here in a minute again. Okay, so you understand how I want you to do it. You write in perfectly grammatically correct, proper punctuation, proper spelling. Your college students at one of the top 100 schools in the nation, business schools in the nation, so you can write like college students, but you write 1 or 2 sentences. I promise you, when you get out there in the real world, your boss asks you a question in an email message. 1, he's going to not want you to write back a dissertation. 2, he's going to want you to write at the level he expected of a college graduate. So those are the 2 things that I expect of you. And you should be able to finish one of my in-class exams, 20, 25 minutes. If you're here for the whole time, which one? Again, it's the number of shares. The technical formula is the number of shares outstanding times the price per share. But the answer that I anticipate for you to give me is that it is the total value of the market's assessment of the total value of the ownership position in the company. Okay, so now, the price-earnings ratio, P-E ratio, this one. Now, I'm sneaking in some actual ratio analysis here. Now, the earnings per share is the net income divided by the number of shares outstanding. When I write earnings, that's another way of saying net income, although I've been told that some accounting professors say that that's not exactly right, but bite me. Okay, earnings is how much money belongs to the shareholders. The company has paid all of its bills that were due in a timely manner. It's taking care of all of its expenses, and what is left, what remains, belongs to the shareholders. That is the earnings. Dividing that by the number of shares outstanding is the amount of that money that belongs to each share of stock. So the earnings of a company, let's say that the earnings and shares outstanding. Let's say that there are 1,000 shares outstanding, and the total earnings are $2,000. The earnings per share would be 2,000 divided by 1,000 shares, or $2 per share. Every share of stock has claim to $2. That's what I mean by residual claim. Every debt holder, from the light bill to the lenders, to Uncle Sam and his taxes, to the wages and salaried people, the shipping, all that, the wholesale, it's all been paid. So what is left, that $2,000, belongs to the shareholders. And if there are 1,000 shares outstanding, each of the shares has a claim, it has claim to $2. Now, the company can put that money back into the company, that's plowback, or it can give it as dividends, or it can do a combination of the two. But whatever it does, it is on behalf of the shareholders. If it gives the shareholders a dividend, well, that's gravy to the shareholders. If it puts it back into the company, all they're doing is reinvesting shareholders' money in what belongs to the shareholders, the corporation, which should, we would hope, bring up the stock price over time. Okay, so now, let's talk about the price. Price per share. Let's say this company's price per share is $10. The P/E ratio would be $10 divided by $2. Which would be 5 times. This is a factor. It's a time symbol after. What this means is that the market is willing to pay 5 times what the company has earned for its shareholders. In other words, for every dollar that the company earns for its shareholders now, the market is willing to pay $5 for that. Because the market believes that the company will turn every dollar that belongs to shareholders into $5 for the shareholders. Again, with a P/E ratio of 5, the market has assessed that $1 of current shareholder money will create $5 of shareholder money. And it will take you a while to get your mind around what that means. And we'll talk about it over and over again, like we do everything, try to do everything. But look, the P/E ratio is actually sort of a risk measure. Like beta. It's a rougher one, and some analysts really prefer it to beta because they see beta as more academic and kind of like esoteric and more long haul, more long term. P/E ratio, if the P/E ratio is high, that means that market participants are willing to pay a bunch of money for a dollar of current earnings. I mean, a P/E ratio of 20 says the market's going to pay $20 to claim $1, because the market thinks that $1 that belongs to the shareholders now, the company will turn into $20 over the fullness of time. Now, just as a historical reference, back in my time, a P/E ratio of 20 or 30 would have been nosebleed. We would have been really freaked by that. Now, that's pretty common stuff. That's pretty normal. You got P.E. ratios of 50. Hell, back in the heyday, you had 100, 200. The record was held on the Nikkei index. There was a stock, that's the Japanese stock exchange. There was a stock. There were stocks there that were running with P.E. ratios of 20,000. In other words, investors were willing to pay $20,000 for every $1 the company had just earned. They thought that the company earned $1 this time, the company can turn that $1 of the shareholder money into $20,000 of shareholder money. That didn't work out in the end. It didn't. The Nikkei crashed really, really hard. And you can see why. When you got P.E. ratios like that, that's just insane. So one thing that you might want to watch out for is just looking at stocks. If their P.E. ratios are high, that's a measure of risk. Now, interestingly enough, look at this stock. You see Target's beta and its P.E. ratio, they're consistent, safe. You see a lot of stocks where the P.E. ratio and the beta are telling you different stories. And what I use, they say, well, why is that? You said they were both measures of risk. So why are they saying different things? I also said beta is a longer term, a long haul metric. P.E. ratio is just animal action of the day. And it doesn't tell you the longer term investment prospect. And I trust beta more because I'm much more strongly recommending buy and hold strategies than I am just hopping around from stocks to stocks. But anyway, next thing, dividend and yield. The dividend, they're paying $2.40. The yield is just that number divided by the price. So in other words, in this case, it's almost like they're telling you the percent on a passbook savings account. You put in $63.42 into this savings account, and you will get a yield, a percent yield on it of 3.76%. You see, and that's actually pretty darn good. I mean, in other words, whatever happens to the price of this stock, right now, Target, you're going to make 3.75% investing, and investing in a very safe stock, too. As long as it's, but remember, it's safe only in a well-diversified portfolio. Now, last thing. When your target estimate, that is, okay. Madam, I am the psychic Professor Darkness. I will tell you your future. Indeed, I will tell you your life and your death. I have a crystal ball I can look into, and I can see everything. Do you believe me?
Yeah.
You do? Well, that's just because I'm so damn charming. But no, the reality is that you should be cynical. I want you all to be cynical bastards. If I can't do that, at least I want you to be mildly irritable by the time you get out of here. Now, when you see this estimate, the one-year target estimate, who did that estimate? Do you know? Well, I can tell you right now that I think I do know. And it's not a good story. It's actually kind of a dark story, okay? It's my cat, Phineas. My cat gets on the internet to tell people lies. I've caught him, and I'm actually going to show you pictures of it. I will. And if it wasn't him, then it was this guy named Lonnie who does blow, and then he writes financial forecasts. And if it wasn't him, it was this guy who travels to Russia to have interesting things done in motel rooms. Or it was some crackpot on TV named Kramer, who screams and rants and sweats and does all kinds of things to try to cover up the videos that were released several years ago that showed what a jackass and a human scumbag he is. Okay? You see, there's no reason for you to believe that number. There's no reason whatsoever. It's just a number. Don't ever believe a projection from anybody, because if they were that good, they wouldn't be doing web pages on the interwebs. They would actually have already made a fortune, and they'd be living the life of Riley out on an island off the coast of Cabo San Luca. Don't believe anyone who tells you what the market is going to do, especially anyone who gives you a number for a stock price. If they were that good, they wouldn't be doing this. Except Phineas, he is good at it, but he won't tell you the right answers. Now I'm going to take you over to financials for a few minutes. And to do this, we're going to go to www.sec.gov. And we're going to go on the filings down to company filing search. And then we're going to type in TGT to get to targets. And here we go. Now notice here that Target is not quite up to where their last 10K got cleared out here. It's around the second week of March that the K will come out. Now that would mean that Target is actually probably its fiscal year is the same as its calendar year, but you get it all over the place. I mean, you get companies that have their fiscal year end in September, so you'll see the 10K come out in October or November. There's one company, I can't remember what it is. I just showed it and I didn't realize what was happening. Its fiscal year 2017 ended in January. So it's now in fiscal year 2018. But, I mean, they're all over the place. The one problem here is that I do appreciate that this 10K, the information in it is old news. It's a year old. I mean, within minutes, the information in that 10K was devoured and impounded in the stock price. So there's nothing new to learn from this, but it is good as a teaching tool and also as a research tool. As I told you, you're going to have classes where they're going to have you do analysis of companies and all of that. Hell, going to a 10K is one of the best things you can do to get all the information you want to blow them away. When you go in for an interview for a job, the other people going for the interview, I can guarantee you they're not going to look at 10Ks and 10Qs. Guarantee you. But if you go in there and peruse a little bit, look at the financials, and have a look at the management discussion and analysis, you'll have a leg up on anyone. You can ask questions and discuss things that no other candidate could. So even though the 10K is probably not going to do you any good for investment work, at the same time, you know, it's worth other things. By the way, notice the 8Ks. Remember what I told you the 8Ks were? Those are simply reports of non-recurring events. Just out of curiosity, I'm just curious to see one of them. A lot of them are ridiculously dull. Well, yep. The hell? Those are for outside acquisitions. Well, that's interesting. Okay, 14D, 13E, that's some kind of activity. Acquiring interest in something else. Well, that's kind of interesting. It was kind of worth it to have a look at that little sweetie. Okay, anyway, let's get down here. Don't ask me. I mean, it just kind of surprised me there when I saw that. I was expecting it to be, well, the president of the company turned into a monkey last night or something silly. But, I mean, when you see something like that, that'll stop you in your tracks. Wait, Target, in communication with the SEC about a 14D matter? Anyway. Now, moving along, consolidated. Here's the thing. First of all, numbers don't matter as much as percentages and percent changes. So I'm going to tell you right now, and I'm surprised that a lot of you tell me quite honestly that in your math courses and previous business courses, You haven't seen this formula, or it's really not been emphasized, but it's one of the simplest but most useful little stupid math formulas you can have for business and for a lot of other things too. It's the percent change formula. Percent delta, the percent change, will always be the ending value minus the beginning value over the beginning value. That's the percent change formula. And it is so useful because instead of looking at, see that row of those sales numbers? Well, yeah, it went from 71.2 to 72.6 to 73.8. Yep, looks good to me. No, now we can look at the percent changes in that amount. And that's when it gets, that's why this, look, this is a dry subject. It's kind of dull up front. If you like it, great. You're a little bit too much like me, but I do appreciate this can be dull. But then what we're doing here is we are actually teasing out what the data has that's not right there on the surface. We are essentially, you become something very special. You become the data whisperer. Mm-hmm. I know, right? I tried to do that. I tried to be the cat whisperer. The cat walked away. My breath was bad. Anyway, okay, so now, again, remember, always do this with a scientific calculator. Okay, so now I'm going to put this over here. Ready? We're going to look at the change from sales from 72 from 14 to 15 first. And to do that, I'm going to open the parentheses. 72. Is there some reason why they make fonts so small anymore, or am I just getting that old? 72.6. Is that an 8? Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you for helping. Don't let me straight all of you there. Really? Let's try this again. I actually have these numbers, but I hate just showing you. Here's the answers. Because that's like showing you how I did it and then expecting you not to see the, how it's done. Okay, 72.618. Is there some reason this sucks? 618. Noon lock was on. Minus 71279. 71279, close the parentheses, divided by 71279. 71279. This will tell us the growth rate of sales from 14 to 15. And that sucks. That's about a 1.88% growth rate. That's not even as fast as the economy is growing. I'm not even sure if that covers inflation. Well, that's a little bit of a problem. That's concerning. But, oh, thank God. Thank God that was just from 14 to 15. It's gotten obviously better, 15 to 16. Let's go ahead and do that one. That one would be, open parenthesis, 73785 minus 72618, close the parentheses, divided by 72618, 72618. And, of course, it'll be a lot better, a lot better. Uh-oh. It's not. It's worse. A 1.6% growth rate in sales. It's actually decelerating. That's negative acceleration in the growth rate. Bad sign. I mean, I went to a Catholic school. If I did something wrong, the nun would paddle me on my hand. Bad fat boy. Bad fat boy. This is bad target. Bad target. Okay? Weirdo. You see, the thing of it is, understand that I'm really concerned. This is not good. right off the bat. When you see, I mean, there are a lot of things that can go on in a company. You know, you could have the costs go up, a one-time charge against earnings or something like that. Or you might have a spike as you do some work to upgrade your facilities. But this is just pure sales. Sales is the first and most important of all the things you are going to do. You are not going to become a successful company by cutting your costs. You are not going to become a successful company by figuring out how to keep the lights on dim. You're not going to become a successful company by figuring out a cool depreciation trick to make your financials look better. You will become a successful company first and foremost by selling the product. Nothing else matters at the beginning. And I can tell you that as a real businessman. When I go out there in my art exhibit, if I don't sell, everything else is nothing. I can be the most creative genius in the world. I can make a lot of friends. I can have people just love me to death and love my art. But if they don't buy it, I got nothing. And so Target has shown that it's the worst weakness it could have. The worst weakness it could have is the weakness that it does have. Bad sign. Now, here's an interesting thing. Most companies don't do this anymore, and I'm glad to see Target does it. They give the gross. Now, technically, they're not using the right term here. This should be gross income. Gross margin is when you take the gross income divided by the sales. Okay? So what we're looking at here, again, the number doesn't matter. The first thing that I would want to do is, in this case, is to actually calculate the gross margin, which is not what that they're saying. Okay, the gross margin is gross income over sales. In other words, how much of every dollar that went into the cash drawer survived paying for the goods that generated the cash? In this case, if I were to do, let's say, 2015, I would do 21,340, 21,340 divided by 72,618. 72,618. $0.29 of every dollar survived paying the wholesale price to get the retail dollar. So now let's move on to this year, this previous year. Now keep that one in mind, 29.4 cents. Now I'm going to do 2016, 21,788 divided by 73,785. A little worse. Oh, well, a little better, but not anything to write home about. I can't say, well, this everything's okay now. It's not. They have about the same gross margin both years. So, I mean, they're not saving any money on wholesale prices and all that kind of stuff. Now, you go on down, and I'm going to bring up this guy right here, earnings from continuing operations before interest and taxes. This is operating income, or you'll hear me call it EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. You can use any of those terms for it. They use a little bit fancier one. Now, this is the number that is how much is left after all expenses have been paid that are operating related. After your wholesale prices, after you've paid your wages and salaries, your light bill, all of that, this is how much is left. Okay? So it's, and this number has a particular importance because see the number below it? That is your interest expense. And one of the ratios that we care about a lot, now I'm not, like I said, I'm not going to go through all the ratios. I'm going to talk to you one that I consider the key, is times interest earned. Times interest earned is simply operating income divided by interest expense. Now remember, operating income is nothing but EBIT, interest before interest and earnings before interest and taxes. So operating income is just EBIT. There's just different names for the same thing. Remember that. Don't ever forget that. Now, in other words, with the money that is available to pay your interest, how many times over can you do it? Now, this number has to be above one, because if it's not above one, the company cannot pay its interest expense. Now remember, the interest expense is debt holder. Do you remember what I said, what I told you happens if you can't pay your debt holders? Do you remember that? What? What can the debt, what will, not what can, what will the debt holders do the day you can't pay your bills?
Yeah, I don't remember.
They will shoot your dog. They will sell your Bible on Craigslist, and they will make your mama wear furry costumes. I know, right, Mrs. Fox? Yes. Look, they will shut you down. If that gets even close to one, you are in trouble. So in other words, the higher above one, the better? No. The higher the above one, it's great for a while, but the problem is that if it goes too far above one, you are not effectively using debt. In this case, if you were to work out for the last year, target comes out to be 9.11 times. In other words, I think it's I'm trying to remember all the numbers in my head for target, but I'm pretty sure. Well, shoot, let me just do it here. Just I can't trust my own mind sometimes. Okay. 5530 divided by 607, 5530 divided by 607. Yeah, 9.11. You see, it's safely away from one. In other words, they can pay their interest expense. However, my question would be, is it too far away from one? They clearly don't have a lot of interest expense compared to their money that they could pay interest with. And what that means, though, is that they may not be taking advantage of the most powerful way for a company to magnify the wealth of its owners, its shareholders. Again, this company may not be using the most powerful way to magnify the wealth of its shareholders. And this is one of the most important principles of business. And it sounds like I'm being saying a joke, but I'm not. Madam, do you know what I mean by OPM? You never heard of it. You look savvy. What's OPM? Got no idea. Dear God. OPM? Nope. Other people's money. It sounds like I'm joking, but I guarantee you I'm not. It is called gains to leverage. If I borrow money at 8%, whatever I make above 8% is gravy to me. So if I can magnify my operations, I pay the lenders back 8%. regardless of what happens to me. If I make less than 8%, I just go out of business and walk away and start another business. But if I make 12%, the 4% is gravy. If I make 40%, the 32% is gravy. If I use that money and magnify it so that I make 90%, I get to keep all but 8% of that money. So whenever you use other people's money, as long as they get a fixed amount back, which debt holders do, they get a coupon of interest, everything above that is sauce on my roast beef. Okay, I recommend cranberry sauce. It is very good, a slight bit of rosemary. I digress. Now, you understand? Other people's money. And it's not a joke. And when a company, well, we don't like to get into debt at all. We stay out of debt. Well, good for you. Give yourself a cookie. If you use that debt, your shareholders would benefit from it. But you don't use that debt, then you are the only thing that is going to make that company grow is the shareholders' own money. In other words, let me go on here. Net margin. Net margin is your net income divided by your sales. Net margin is your net income divided by your sales or net earnings. In this case, we got 33.63 divided by 73.785, a 4.56%. In other words, of every dollar that comes into the cash registers at Target, the shareholders get 4.5 cents. Now, they can get it as dividend or plow back into the company or a combination of those, whatever. But every dollar that goes into the cash drawer at Target, you can look at that. You can look at it. You go in there and you say, did you know that, you tell the cashier, did you know that that dollar I just gave you, 4.5 cents of it will make it to the bottom line for the shareholders? And they'll ask you if you want to apply for a Target credit card or whatever. But it's important. Understand, net margin can be all over the place. There's no rule on it. You'll see. There are some businesses that are so just the person doing something as a service. You can have net margins. I saw one, it was like a net margin of like, it was like 80%, I think. I mean, ridiculously high. Net margin for some businesses is very low. For example, traditionally, the gigantic multinational oil companies, their net margin was less than a penny per dollar. But it was they made such billions at the revenue line that still meant that their shareholders were making out like bandits. And then you got companies all over the place in between, anywhere from 2 cents up to 18 cents, I see. Just if I understand my numbers, and I might be calculating it wrong, it looks like my net margin in my company is 12 cents. In other words, for every dollar I make in sales, I am keeping 12 cents of that on average. But what's interesting is that it is quite different depending upon what product I'm talking about. So that net margin can be all over the place. And divisionally, you can see some of your divisions selling products with high net margins, others selling products with low net margins. So the combination, the average, might not give the picture of how widely varying the product mix is in terms of net margin. Next thing. Seriously? Okay, balance sheet. A few things just to bring up on the balance sheet. Liquidity ratios generally measure how much liquidity you have. More specifically, they measure how well, you can pay your current liabilities with your current assets. And they are factors. So in other words, with Target, if I take, for example, my total current assets, divided by my current liabilities down here. Now, where the heck are my current liabilities? I see it. 12,622. I should come up with a number of about 1.1, I think, something like that. Yeah, 1.12. That's actually awfully tight. Some companies have much higher liquidity ratios. Some companies have liquidity ratios. This is called the current ratio. Now, this tells you if you could liquidate everything that's current at book value, how many times over would you be able to pay your current liabilities if you had to? In this case, if Target could get book value for all of its current assets, it could pay its current liabilities 1.12 times over. But realistically, some of those, you're never going to get even pennies on book value. The most glaring example is your inventory. Your inventory, if I were to say, all right, Target's total current assets are 14,130. However, inventory, I mean, no one's going to buy your inventory for more than a few pennies on the dollar. So let's take that out, 8,601. So really, Target, as far as liquidity goes, at book, 55,29. And then we divide that by the 12,622 current liabilities. Ouch. Only about 0.44 times over. Target better hope that it doesn't have to pay all of its current liabilities right away. And then there's one last one as far as liquidity goes. And the book calls this the cash ratio. Back in my time, we called it the burn ratio. And I tell you that as a historical reference point, simply in case you ever work for someone who is old school or who was from a different generation. Sometimes you'll hear terminology different. In that case, realistically, the only real money Target's ever going to be able to pull out of thin air quickly, or pull out really quickly, is its cash in the bank, 4046. Divide that one by 12,622, the current liabilities. You're down, they can pay only 32% of their bills. They can pay their current liabilities only 0.32 times over. Now, there are other ones that I could go into here. One thing that I do want to bring up, and again, you've got a nice sheet with these on it. You got a nice sheet with these on it, but you also have, the book will give you a bunch of them too. But one that I want to bring up, and it's part of a larger point. When I talk about ratio analysis, ratios don't exist in a vacuum. The first thing you always have to do is look at the industry. Okay, what's the industry average? Maybe even look at those percent changes in the ratios. Do ratios for a few years and see how the ratios are changing from year to year. That's why Excel is so nice. You can do that in a blink of an eye. It's how I used to do it. But ratios in and of themselves really don't tell you as much as things like changes in ratios. And also, there is no golden standard for ratios. Let me turn on these lights. I'm getting creeped out by how dark it is in here. Here are a couple of ratios. ROA and ROE. And these are a great example of ratios that you think the bigger the better, but that's not true. ROA, return on assets, is your net income, your earnings, divided by your total assets. ROE is net income divided by your owner's equity. So in other words, in the case of Target, shareholder, okay, ROA, where the heck are my total assets? Clear up there. 4262 is the denominator for ROA. And for net income, for ROE, 12,957 is the denominator. Now, the net income, I should be able to remember, but I'm kind of sundowning right now. So let's go back up here to the net income. What was the earnings? 3363. Now let me calculate those out. 3363 divided by 4262 is an 8.35% ROA. 8.35% is the ROA, and the ROA is 3363 divided by 12,957. 25.96%. Okay. Essentially, the ROA says investing the total assets, all of the assets of this company, this is the monetary return to that investment. That's the monetary return to the investment of the total assets. What were they worth when we invested? $40,262. What return did you get on that investment? 8.35%. Okay, now the ROE, how much did the shareholders put in? 12,957. Well, how much did they get out? 3363. So for their investment of 12,957, they earned 25.96%. That's what it means, okay? Now, clearly, the higher those numbers are, the better the returns. But there is a danger, and I'll focus on ROA. And I'll tell you a story. You see how if I can make net income go up, ROA goes up. Great. But do you also see that if I make total assets go down, ROA goes up? So in other words, if I just sit back and burn up my assets, don't reinvest, let accounting and economic depreciation do their thing over a period of years, total assets will naturally fall. And if you're still doing the work, the net income will go up and your ROA will go up for all the wrong reasons. This is what happened in the oil refining business. After the 1970s, there were no new refineries built. Hardly anything was done to the old refineries. But because gas prices just kept going up and up and up, net income of the refiners just kept going up and up, and the value of their total assets kept going down because of accounting depreciation, but also because of economic depreciation underlying it. So you had ROA going through the roof. Oh, the greatest thing in the world. ROA was skyrocketing. until you got to the point in the first decade of the 21st century when the refineries started exploding, killing workers, driving families by the thousands and thousands out of their communities, wiping out coastal waterways where fishermen and trappers and ocean trappers worked. It was a disaster because those refineries had played the game of inflating ROA by dropping total assets. Oh, yeah, on Wall Street. The Wall Street boys like to tell these companies, oh, get rid of half your workforce and we'll buy a bunch of your stock and your stock will go up in price and you'll be a friggin' hero, Mr. CEO, at the next shareholder meeting. We'll buy your stock if all you do is just fire some of your workers and get rid of some of that old equipment of yours and don't replace it. Get more productivity out of each of those workers. Productivity going up, greatest thing in the world, until the day that it is not the greatest thing in the world because your company dies because it doesn't have enough employees and the ones that you've been working to the bone are dead on their feet and they just don't give a rat's ass anymore whether you live or die and whether that company survives. That's what you can do. You can artificially inflate ROA. Great thing. Now, I'm going to go on here for just a bit with time value of money by referring back to price earnings ratios. Let me clear this. Price earnings ratio. A price of a stock represents the telescoped value of what the market thinks is going to happen in the future. We don't actually care about the past at all. But the problem is that the future is not the present. And if you were to tell me $100 as a business person, the first thing I would ask is when? Because it is just like you tell me, well, how tall are you? You say 70. I have no idea what you're talking about unless you give me a unit of measure. And if it's not the unit of measure I understand or that I normally work with, I would have to convert it. So, sir, I have $100. Would you like that $100 now or in a year? You greedy. Oh, yeah, it's all about now. You see, later is not worth as much as now. That's my key. I wondered where that key was. No, seriously, noobs. I would tear up my car. Wow, okay. You see, $100, you don't, $100 now, you could go out and buy a friend tonight or rent one on Facebook. You could have a cheeseburger tonight. You could do a lot of things tonight with that money. But if you have to wait a year, you could starve to death from lack of cheeseburgers or lack of friendship. Or it could even be the case that I will die within a year. And then, where are you then? Or I could be taken up in an alien spaceship, mothership. You see me going up, and I'm holding on to the cow. We're both being taken up. Okay? So what I want to do is propose to you a formula. The future value of money is the present value times 1 plus the periodic interest rate to the number of periods. And this is the periodic interest rate, the R, and N is the number of periods. Now, you've got to be careful because almost always when I give you an interest rate, I will give you an annual interest rate. So if it is actually something other than annual, you have to fix it. So you invest $20,000 in an account that pays 12% interest compounded quarterly. How much do you have after 10 years? And it's actually not that hard to do. Because what I'm going to do is I'm going to say the future value of that money is the $20,000 now times 1 plus 0.12 over 4 to the 4 times 10. You have to divide quarterly would be 4. Now, if I had said semi-annual, what would have been the number?
2.
If I did monthly, now here's the one that bothered me. Back before I could do this stuff online, there were almost every semester I'd do a weekly, and I'd have inevitably 20, 30 students say, how many weeks are in a year? 52. But the one that is most important here is if I say daily, you would think that it's 365. Well, actually, traditionally, you would put a 360 in the denominator and a 365 in the exponent. And it was just that was the way it was done. Now, the book, I think, says use 360 in both places. I'm not sure about that. But you just do whatever the house rule is. And by the way, the answer on this one, which I forgot to, I just killed it, just so you can have it to make sure that you can do it, would be 20,000 times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.12 divided by 4, close the parenthesis, and raise that to the 40th power, 65, 240, 76. There it is. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.